Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of September 30th, 2011. You know, in a rocky stock market like this one, it's good to have a healthy dose of skepticism.
Bear in mind that those little voices that tell you, oh, I'm underinvested, are usually leading you in at the wrong time.
We'll explain the coward's portfolio. And to learn about finance, you could read books, you could listen to, say, a radio show, or you could play a game.
I've seen how much money has been a problem, and I never even thought that, like, bonds can help you, or, like, you could invest to make, like, your own money grow.
Plus, no one is too smart to fall for investment scams.
I interviewed a guy who was a retired chemistry professor. He lost $900,000 to a movie investment scam. And when you ask him, well, why didn't you ask all these questions? Because it never occurred to me that somebody would lie.
Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
So I seriously hope that you have taken our advice to heart and are averting your eyes from the daily madness of the stock markets. Europe's debt problems and our sad economy are combining to create a world of crazy. If it's all too much for you and you're looking for a way to deal, how about something called a coward's portfolio?
Why, you're nothing but a great big coward.
You're right. I am a coward. I haven't any courage at all.
John Wagoner is a personal finance columnist for USA Today, and he wrote about this recently. John, who is this portfolio geared for?
It's basically designed for those who are terrified by the stock market, which I think right now is about everybody. What we did was we took 20% and put it in a money market fund, and we put 30% and put it in a bond fund, and the remaining 50% is in a stock fund, and not just any stock fund, but really one that's craven, really, as cowardly as possible. So we went for an equity income fund, which is kind of the milquetoast of the stock mutual fund world.
So this really is all about simplicity.
Oh, absolutely. It's about simplicity, and it's about spreading your bets around. This is a time when you really don't want your eggs in any one basket. And in fact, you want to be as diversified as humanly possible.
Well, have you done some math on how well they would do? Have you taken a look, say, if you had done this 10 years ago, how would you have fared?
Well, you would have done fairly well, actually. Now, bear in mind that the S&P 500 is kind of like, you know, arm wrestling with a mouse at this point. But you could have done fairly well. I looked at the portfolio using fairly basic indices for it, and it's gained 41% as opposed to 31% for the S&P 500.
Over the last decade?
Over the last decade. Okay. Now, bear in mind, 41% still isn't great. On the other hand, it's better than what you would have gotten in a money fund, and it's better than what you would have gotten in a stock fund.
Now, you say 20% in, I think, money market funds, and then 30% in bonds. What kind of bonds are we talking about?
Well, bonds are problematic right now because the reason this portfolio has done so well is it's just been a monster bond rally over the past 10 years. And you don't usually hear those two terms together.
Right.
But that's what's really kept the cowardly portfolio going. Now, you have a couple choices. So you're at the top of a bond market. And so you could just suck it up and just keep your position there because, after all, you have your bonds because they're there to protect you against stocks. You could buy individual bonds, like two-year treasuries, and you're not going to earn anything. But as they roll over, they'll eventually yield more. And if you hold them to maturity, you won't lose any money.
And for the other 50%, you mentioned just a basic stock fund. What's the best way to go about picking one of those?
You want to look at two things. Past performance, as we all know.
Not indicative of future results.
Absolutely. So there are a couple things you control, one of which is your expenses. You want to give as little as possible to your mutual fund company because, after all, that will decrease your returns over time. And you also basically want to look for one that has a good record of finding decent dividend-producing stocks. You want a fund that gives something back to you because you're in there not only for the appreciation but for the income that this thing will throw off.
So it sounds like this really is not anything that you would base on your age or anything like that. It really is all about your personal risk tolerance, which we talk about all the time, and this is a way to make yourself not perhaps be such a scaredy cat.
That's right. It's all about the terror. And, you know, as you become more confident, you can increase stocks. Bear in mind that those little voices that tell you, oh, I'm underinvested, are usually leading you in at the wrong time. So I'd say, you know, keep it simple, keep it cowardly. As things get better, and they do, stocks will pick up where your bonds left off.
John Wagoner is a personal finance columnist for USA Today. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And we've got a profile of another investing strategy called locavesting on our Making Money blog at marketplace.org. We mentioned the European debt crisis, and one side effect of that has been a bump in the value of the U.S. dollar. We asked Chris Hewen to help us with what that means. He's a professor of finance at the University of Denver's Daniels College of Business. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
As we all, as Americans, look at what's happening in Europe, I suppose the only bright spot that we could possibly see is that the dollar has somehow strengthened.
Sure. When you see a stock market decline like we had last week, the dollar definitely is viewed as a safe haven. And we as Americans do pretty well because the dollar goes up in value.
So tell us what that means for us.
It's so complex to understand because there is a wide-ranging mixture of effects. If the dollar strengthens, of course, buying things from other countries becomes cheaper. But it also creates problems in other areas. One of the issues is that a lot of U.S. companies depend on foreign sales. And when the dollar goes up significantly in value, it makes these revenues and profits overseas actually less valuable.
And I guess 7% over the last, month or so, that's certainly not a significant rise. But it is something. Is there any way for consumers to take advantage, and how?
I tend to view the dollar as actually being fairly weak right now, and for very good reason. The U.S. economy is close to dipping back into a recession. The Federal Reserve System has promised to hold interest rates near zero to 2013. And there isn't a lot of reason for people to buy the U.S. dollar except as just sort of a safe haven. I think that the better question is what countries to avoid, as opposed to what countries to find value in, because you've got a number of countries that have seen huge appreciations in their currencies. Brazil, Switzerland, and Japan, they all have very strong currencies. And I think from the standpoint of the U.S. consumer, you have to be very wary about traveling to these countries or buying goods from these countries. This is not the time to buy your high-end Swiss watch right now with the Swiss franc doing so well.
Is there anywhere where perhaps the strengthening American dollar could do you a favor?
Germany is, of course, one of the major countries in the eurozone. They have the euro. The euro has been beat down somewhat because of the crisis. And Germany actually seems relatively cheap because their economy is doing very well. And their real estate prices are relatively cheap right now compared to other countries in Europe. If you look at the major currencies right now, the U.S. dollar is one, the Japanese yen is another, and the euro is the third one. What's kind of interesting is that these are all ugly dogs right now, and the U.S. dollar actually looks relatively good even though we have such a weak economy because of the situation in Japan. They're trying to recover from
tsunami.
Exactly, the tsunami, and the situation in Greece as well is holding down the euro. So relatively speaking, the dollar looks pretty good.
Good bit of news for a change. Dr. Chris Hewen is professor of finance at the University of Denver's Daniels College of Business. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Eurozone may be in deep financial doo-doo right now, but one of its recent exports shows more than a little money savvy. It's a financial literacy board game, and we sent Ashley Milne-Tite to see how it's translated to an audience of American students.
Most of the 13 New York City high school kids in this room have barely thought about personal finance before. Now they're gathered around a table in an office at the city's Department of Youth and Community Development, DICE at the ready. They're about to play a game called Nest Egg.
On the stock market, what we're going to do is we're going to rotate around so that everyone can roll the die. You're going to determine what happens to stocks first.
That's Erin Cantor, head of marketing for Nest Egg. She acts as the banker during the game. Here's how you play. Kids form small teams. Each team acts as a financial advisor for a fictional young couple who wants to buy a home, save for their child's college fund, and retire 30 years from now, debt-free. It's up to the players to achieve those goals. A roll of the dice can bring a boon or a disaster. Vladimir Fichtner is one of the game's inventors.
You know, stocks go up and down, bonds, money market, they're all part of the game.
If you're wondering about the accent, Fichtner is from the Czech Republic. He and some friends came up with the idea for Nest Egg in the 1990s. At the time, Czech citizens were grappling with how to handle their own finances after decades under communism, when the state took care of everything and there were no stock or bond markets. Today, Nest Egg is played in hundreds of schools in the Czech Republic and by trainee bankers at the country's largest bank.
Final Wall Street.
Come on, Sube.
Where's the other guy?
In New York, the Department of Youth and Community Development is experimenting with the game. If today's pilot goes well, it could be rolled out in after-school community centers and possibly in high schools later on. The department's Luis Osorio says the kids who hang out at community centers tend to come from poorer families and really need financial coaching.
Kids don't sit down and say, Dad, how much you make? Do we have insurance? Do we have any investments?
Osorio and his colleagues say poor money management is at least part of the reason for this sobering statistic. 40% of New York City public school graduates who go on to one of the city's colleges drop out within 2 years.
All right. Just roll the die.
One child. So you're going to decrease your cash flow by $50. Oh, so
move
back two spaces to cover the cost.
Nest Egg has been introduced into the high school curriculum almost 2,000 miles away in Corpus Christi, Texas. Carol Loeb teaches economics at King High School. She says before, it was hard to get her students to grasp concepts they had no experience with, but that's all changed. She recalls one student who was failing. Then his class started playing the game.
That is the first time the whole semester this kid had come alive. He could not wait to get in the classroom. He came in and he told me what he had thought about the night before, what he wanted to do, what he wanted to invest in, and he was totally engaged.
Do you have 24,000?
Back in New York, the game is wrapping up.
So how's this team doing?
Bad.
Because we forgot to buy the disability insurance, so we went to the negatives. But we got ourselves down to the positives, but still.
Brendis Gonzalez and her teammates wanted to make $300,000 for their fictional couple's retirement. They ended up with far less because they drew an accident card and hadn't bought disability insurance. Their family went bankrupt and had to start from scratch. Afterwards, Gonzalez says she made some big mistakes, but she's learned from them. She'd like to use her newfound financial knowledge to help her widowed mother, a home health aide.
I've seen how much money has been a problem, and I never even thought that like bonds can help you, or like you could invest to make like your own money grow.
She's never spoken to her mother about money, but says she's about to start. I'm Ashley Milne-Tide for Marketplace Money.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it is that time in the show when we take your money questions. With me this week is Kathy Kristoff, personal finance columnist for Kiplinger's Magazine. Hi, Kathy.
Hey, Tess.
So you've been calling people names recently, I see.
I wasn't calling them names. I just reported on a study, actually very small, but they studied a group of stockbrokers and a group of imprisoned psychopaths. Mm-hmm. And they were trying to figure out how egotistical and willing to cooperate each group was. And they found out that the stockbrokers were more reckless and manipulative than the psychopaths.
Well, you know, anyone who's lived through the last 3 years might not be surprised at that.
You know? Yeah. Pretty amusing. I mean, and it's a terribly small study, so it may not hold up. Who knows?
Right.
But it probably is a kind of compelling argument for knowing what you're doing and not just putting all of your financial life into the hands of a stockbroker.
Well, what does that tell us about the people who invest for us?
I mean, really and truly, I don't know that this tells us that much, except for you need to know what you're doing.
Yeah.
You need to have basic knowledge, because if you don't, you can't actually differentiate the good stockbroker from the psychopath. And so you need to actually inform yourself on the basics of investing.
And that really speaks to, not just handing over a big chunk of money and saying, here, you deal with it, which I think so many people are tempted to do because they don't know the basics and they don't have the time, they think, to learn. So let me just go with this person who my uncle said is a great money manager.
Oh, yeah. But that's exactly how people found Bernie Madoff. You know, Alan Stanford, all these people who were just complete crooks. So the basics are pretty easy. And honestly, you can figure this stuff out in a couple of hours. I mean, I wrote an investing book, as you know. And
give us the title of that book.
Investing 101. It literally take you 2 hours to read it. And,
right.
And it tells you as much as you need to know. You don't really need to have deep understanding. You just basically need to know what different investments do, and that will give you enough information to know when somebody's lying to you.
All right. So shall we turn to our callers?
Let's do that.
And hopefully no one has been investing with any psychos. Shadi is with us from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hi there.
Hi.
What do you do there in Oklahoma?
Not much. I work at an insurance company and I go to school.
You go to school? Are you in college?
No, I'm in high school.
Oh, we have a high school student. What year are you?
I'm a senior.
Do you know where you're going to school? Are you planning to go to school?
I'm really trying to get into NYU. It's been my dream school for a really long time.
What do you want to study?
I want to be a doctor. I'm going to do pre-med track and probably major in anthropology. And
wow. That's great. That's a lot of schooling.
Yeah.
Sounds like you have a plan, though.
Yeah. I've been something my parents have really pushed to make sure that I'm not just like jumping into it, like not knowing what I want to expect, if that makes sense.
Right. No, absolutely. So have you guys been talking for a while about how you're going to fund this effort? Should that happen for you?
Yeah. My parents are both, my dad's a pastor and my mom has always worked with him. So we've never had like a super steady income, but my parents have never felt like they're not doing what they're supposed to. Income has been sort of like fluctuating, and right now they're actually both unemployed. The ministry we were involved in moved out to California, which I think is where you guys are.
Yeah, we are, indeed.
So, my parents didn't feel like that's what we needed to do because the cost of living is just so high there.
It is.
And right now, I mean, we don't have a stable income. I'm really going to have to pay for college myself.
What kinds of options are you looking at?
Well, something my guidance counselor has always been pushing is going onto certain websites and like they will have like an index of different scholarships you can like apply from different institutions,
mm-hmm.
ranging in price from like $500 to like a full ride anywhere you want to go all the way to your PhD, you know? So there's like, it's overwhelming how many options there are.
Well, have you done the basics and filled out the FAFSA form, the free application for federal student aid?
I can't do that until January.
That's going to be your first step, though. And there is one site that I think is pretty one-size-fits-all for the private scholarships, and it's called FastWeb. Between those two, those will really help you. What will happen is when you've applied to colleges and after you filled out the FAFSA form, the colleges will come back to you with financial aid offers. So if they accept you, they're going to accept you and they're going to offer you some sort of aid. That, I think, is when you start making the decision about what you do, don't you think?
Yeah, and I'm actually kind of in a unique position because my sophomore year, I applied to an early college in Massachusetts, and I got in.
As a sophomore?
Yeah, I didn't end up going because of money, yay. But
very impressive, though.
Yeah, but I had to fill out a FAFSA and a CSS profile, and what happened was the income that my parents do make, the expected family contribution was a certain amount of money, and then the school offered me money, and it was actually quite a bit of money. Like, I could have gone if I was a little older and could, you know, hold a job or something. The difference is now is I don't know how much I should rely on schools giving me money from their own grants and stuff that they have and how much I should apply for independent scholarships because I have a little book and it's talking about like how to get into the right college. And it was telling me that you should be careful when you're applying for independent scholarships because they can make your expected family contribution higher when you're applying with your FAFSA and all that fun stuff.
You know, it doesn't actually make your expected family contribution higher. Your expected family contribution is whatever it is, but they will give you less aid someplace else. So if you get a scholarship over here, they take that out of your scholarship grants. It doesn't change your expected family contribution at all, but it may be coming out of your aid. So what you need to do is typically an aid award is going to be made up of a bunch of different things, scholarships, grants, work study, loans, right? And what you want to do is tell the school, if you get a private scholarship, you want it to replace loans in your financial aid package. And it sounds like you're a really great student, so they'll probably agree to that.
But Kathy, let me ask you, you know, Shadi was mentioning that she was reading that you know, there are these rules that you have to watch out for, that in essence you're almost trying to game the system so that you can get as much out of it as possible. Is it really that necessary to be so eagle-eyed?
There are a lot of mistakes that people make when they fill out that FAFSA form. I always recommend a book called Paying for College Without Going Broke by Cal Cheney, and he walks you through line by line what you put on all of those forms. And I think it's, you know, it's whatever, worth the $14 or whatever it is to, yeah, to do it right, because I watch people making simple mistakes all the time where if you read the form and you're not really careful about reading the instructions, they double count assets and it ends up costing you aid.
But this notion that you should, for example, not apply for scholarship X because it will have some sort of effect on you down the line. I mean, why wouldn't you apply for every scholarship you could possibly get?
Absolutely. Apply for every scholarship you can possibly get. It's not that complicated. There are mistakes that people make because the forms are long and somewhat complex. But in your case, it may be a simpler form because your parents are unemployed, and if you earn less than a certain, or your parents earn less than a certain amount, you get to only fill out, I think, the first page of the form, and then everything else is automatic. It kind of makes you 100% aid eligible.
Good year to be unemployed, I guess.
Oh, boy.
You know, right before you go to college, it's a mixed bag. But at least for financial aid purposes, they do recognize. I mean, the biggest factor in how much aid you get is how much you earn. This definitely helps you with aid.
Well, good luck to you. Hey, let us know what ends up happening, would you? We'd love to cheer you on wherever you end up going for school.
Yeah, I definitely will.
All right. Good Thanks luck. So much for the call, Shadi.
Yeah.
All right, let's go next to Betsy in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Betsy.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Very well, thank you. What do you do there in Jersey?
I am a graduate student.
So you could have told Shadi all about student loans and
oh, it's a joy.
The cost of college, yeah.
I have an interesting case. I haven't applied for scholarships even in my undergraduate degree. I've been kind of given them.
Wow.
Heard her talk about what she's going through, and it's my position is more that if you are a good student and you get to know your professors well, for me anyways, they've kind of given me scholarships in the sense, and for her, I feel like it's really good to apply to scholarships when you're first starting, but also, you know, you can get a lot when you're in your second couple years.
Yeah, I think often the more they know you at the school, the better your chances for getting a great scholarship or getting a TA-ship or something that will help you pay for college.
Yeah.
What school are you at? Where are you studying?
I'm at Rutgers University.
Oh, Rutgers.
Studying to be for a master's of city and regional planning.
City and regional planning. So you'll do things like urban growth boundaries?
Something like that. My focus is actually transportation. I'm interested in bicycle and pedestrian planning. That's my focus, and public transportation.
Yeah. Maybe we could bring you out here to L.A., please.
Have a bike path somewhere. Yeah.
The bike paths and also, you know, maybe a little public, a little more public transit.
I would love to do that. L.A.
Okay.
I've never been to L.A., but I've heard they could use some.
So how can we help you today? It sounds like perhaps this is not a question about student loans.
It sort of is. It's kind of related to your last caller. I received a scholarship, a $2,500 scholarship from Rutgers. Question is, what do I do with it? I'm debating whether to put it either in my Roth IRA or to use it to pay off loans.
What loans do you have?
Federal loans, about $35,000 worth for undergrad and graduate. I have one PLUS loan, but most of them are subsidized Stafford loans.
So those are really low-rate loans,
yeah,
except for that one PLUS loan, right?
Yep.
I would hit
that. The PLUS
I mean,
loan?
Yeah, absolutely. Is there something that you were leaning toward and you really want to discuss that before we just say, yeah, pay off the debt?
Well, I guess I'm kind of really a big saver, and I'm kind of like, that's kind of my big thing right now, and I do have a Roth IRA already open, so I do have $2,000 in it already.
Good for you.
Thanks, but I won't have the opportunity, I don't think, to put money into it for a while, just because I'll be graduating in the spring, and then all that money that I have will be put towards basically surviving till I get a job.
Right, and there's the whole, you know, moving to LA.
Right, exactly. Plane tickets are expensive. That was kind of my thought with the IRA, is that I have an opportunity to put money into it now, and I know that accumulates much more the earlier you invest into it.
It does. It's based on compound interest. It is smart to start saving early, But before you make a decision, what you should do is go on a site called finaid.org and plug in your loan amounts. And that will give you an idea of how much you're going to pay each month when you get out of school and how much you pay over time on that 8.5% loan. And I think that might make a compelling argument for you that that actually paying off your debt is equally rewarding. I'm not going to discourage you from saving early. I think that's brilliant. But as long as you have pretty high cost debt, I think your priority has got to be to get rid of that first.
Okay, that makes sense.
Thanks so much for the call, Betsy.
Thank you so much for your help.
One, two, one.
Finally, we have Lisa in Mansfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Lisa.
Hi there.
How are things there in Mansfield?
Oh, we're pretty good.
Excellent. What do you do there?
I am a manager in a software company.
In a software what?
I manage a team of developers in a software company.
Momentarily, I thought you said software spam company. I was like, you don't want to admit that on the air, do you?
No. Let the hate mail ensue. No.
Right. Exactly. Well, what can we help you out with today?
My question is about a mortgage refinance. And I am one of the lucky ones. I am not underwater. We are in good shape. But the rates are so low, it's very tempting.
Well, yeah.
And the problem is?
There's no problem, actually. It's more of an opportunity. So
okay.
I'm looking at my options, and when I look at the choices, I can either, right now we have about 20 years left on our mortgage.
Okay.
I can either reduce the term down to 15 years, or I could extend my term back to 30 years and save about $450 a month over what we pay now.
Woo!
And the difference between the 15-year and the 30 actually adds up to $700 a month. So if we could pay the 15 years, let's assume that's cash I can afford, right? So here's $700 a month that I could not be putting into my mortgage.
Mm-hmm. But what would you do with it otherwise?
That's why I'm calling. Excellent question. So I have a list of options. One of them is obviously reducing the term of the mortgage.
Right.
The second option is I have a six-year-old daughter. We have a 529 for her, and we put money into that now, and I'm wondering if that would be a better use of that just to save for her.
You know what? I mean, I tend to advise people to do the 30-year mortgage simply because it gives you more options. If you decide you want to pay it more quickly, you can.
That's what I was thinking, too. Yep.
Yeah. And that way, you know, like if a year from now, you know, one of you loses a job, you have some big
problem,
expense, yeah, anything that you didn't anticipate, it gives you the flexibility of paying just the amount of the mortgage, which is less than you think you can afford. And so I like that approach. I never overfund a 529 plan, mainly because you don't know where your child is going to go to school. There's a lot of, you know, when she's six and you're talking about 12 years from now, you want to give yourself some flexibility. So I like having some money in your own name that you know you can spend on your child's college, but, you know, is not dedicated to your child's college just in case they get a great scholarship or, you know, whatever. And college is extremely expensive, and I think it's great to emerge from college without any debt. But you don't have to address college with a dedicated savings account.
Right. I hadn't thought of that. I was thinking, okay, it's the 529 or nothing, but that doesn't really have to be the case.
Right. No, it, as a matter of fact, I mean, like I said, I just like giving myself a certain amount of flexibility. And when you put your money in all dedicated savings accounts that, you know, have tax implications, you really are kind of locking yourself into that. Even if you put a certain amount of money in just index funds, which don't throw off a lot of taxable income, if you leave it alone there, it's a form of tax deferred savings, and it doesn't have any strings attached. So I kind of like doing that with part of your money.
Well, that's really great to hear. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much for the call, Lisa.
Okay. Thanks for talking to me.
All right. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or shoot us a note. You can go to our website, which is marketplace.org, and type Getting Personal into the search box. Kathy, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Tess.
And do remember to always talk to your own financial professional before you make any big money decisions.
Hands in my pocket.
Because of your giant wallet, just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
My name is Bruce Hall, and I live in Pasadena, California. And my wallet, no cash. I got my little tap card to get in and out of the music center since I work for the opera. California driver's license, gotta have that. A little note saying there's a possibility I might go up and see someone do their theater in La Quinada, California, because they might want to use me as an actor. I do the boards. When you say boards, that means you work on the wood floors of a theater. It's an old term. That means you do live theater on a stage. When did I get my start? Probably, I would say, when I was in college, probably 40 years ago. You know, I don't really pursue it as much as I used to. I'm 60 years old, and I'm just kind of hanging out at my job here at the LA Opera, and so that's why I kept that little note in there. I might go up and just check out what the scene is.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Don't Ask, Don't Tell ended last week. For almost 18 years, the policy banned gay men, lesbians, and bisexuals from openly serving in the U.S. military. In ending the rule, President Obama said, "Service members will no longer be forced to hide who they are in order to serve our country." But the federal government continues to treat these members of the military differently when it comes to workplace benefits. From Washington, Marketplace's David Gurrow reports.
Defense Secretary Leon Panetta said the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell was historic.
I believe we move closer to achieving the goal at the foundation of the values that America is all about. Equality, equal opportunity, and dignity for all Americans.
Closer, but Lawrence Korb says we've still got a ways to go. He was an assistant secretary of defense when Ronald Reagan was president. Now Korb's a fellow at the Center for American Progress, a liberal think tank. He says in the military, gays and lesbians are still at a disadvantage.
They are not eligible for all those benefits that heterosexual members of the military get.
Korb says a gay or lesbian couple couldn't get the same housing benefits as a straight couple, a military ID card, or family separation allowance. A partner or a spouse wouldn't get the same health care benefits.
And they would not be allowed to shop at the commissaries and the exchanges as the dependents of other service people would be.
Jeff Schmaltz is gay and lives in Dartmouth, Massachusetts. He spent 25 years in the military, in the Army and the National Guard. Schmaltz chose to retire in 2004, after Massachusetts began to recognize same-sex marriages. He says leaving the military to get married was a difficult decision.
You know, if I had gotten married and, you know, and stayed in the military, and I was found out, I would have lost all military benefits, including a retirement at age 60.
Now, 7 years after he left the military, he's still worried about what will happen to the benefits he's eligible to collect.
What's really important to me is that if I should die before my partner, I would like for him to be able to have access to those benefits in the same way as, you know, the spouses of straight soldiers.
Right now, his partner, Andy, wouldn't have access to those benefits. The Defense Department wouldn't talk to me on tape, but Eileen Lanez, a department spokeswoman, said that to a certain extent, the Pentagon's hands are tied by something called the Defense of Marriage Act. That became law back in 1996. Lee Badgett teaches economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst.
It said basically that that states would not have to recognize the marriages from other states of same-sex couples and that the federal government would not recognize them.
Now, the Obama administration has said it thinks the law is unconstitutional and the Justice Department isn't going to defend it in court, But federal agencies are still bound by the current law.
They can't change that on their own. Either Congress has to change it or it has to be struck down by the courts.
Some federal agencies have tried to find ways around the law. The State Department offers access to medical services abroad, diplomatic passports, and covers moving expenses for LGBT spouses. The Department of Labor is making federal family and medical leave available to these spouses. The availability of benefits is a sticking point for retired military who want to reenlist. David McKean with the Service Members Legal Defense Service says he's been overwhelmed with calls. He says most of them are worried about the same thing, their families.
They want to know that they're going to be cared for in the same way that we expect everybody else to be cared for.
Jeff Schmaltz says this is about fairness, that gays, lesbians, and bisexuals deserve equal treatment across the board.
You know, if they are serving in the military or if they're serving in industry, they should be receiving the same benefits as everyone else.
Economics professor Lee Badgett says the tides may be turning. A third of state and local governments offer benefits to same-sex partners, and a third of the private sector does too. And now 13 of the top 25 defense contractors offer substantial benefits to the partners of LGBT employees. Defense Department spokeswoman Eileen Lanez says the military is now exploring expanding benefits. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace Money.
Take a look in the mirror, would you? Now, based on what you see, do you think you're paid better or less than other people? Well, the fact is, folks, the bombshell beauties and handsome devils among us have an inherent advantage when it comes to money. And we are not just talking salary. Daniel Hammermisch has a new book out called Beauty Pays: Why Attractive People Are More Successful. He teaches economics at the University of Texas at Austin. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I must tell you, I paid a lot of attention to what I am wearing for this interview. So let me describe it for you. I've got on a strapless black long ball gown, 3-inch heels. My hair is swept into an updo, and I've got, some fun stuff dangling from my ears.
Well, you know, I think that's wonderful, and my guess is it's quite sexy looking, but wearing all these things, all the earrings, all the high heels, there's a lot of evidence it really doesn't enhance your beauty as others perceive it very much.
Okay, well, I've actually got on jeans and a red sweater and some red flats, so.
That's not going to hurt you either.
Well, let's start right with something in your book that may shock some folks. People that are perceived to be better looking earn much more than those with below average looks. Of course, this is not the shocking part. What is how much more? Can you say what that is?
Well, there have been a lot of studies on this, not just for the U.S., but for a number of foreign countries. And of course, like any studies, they vary. But one study, which I was responsible for, says that among Americans, the top third of lookers will earn probably $230,000 more over their lifetimes than with those in the bottom seventh of looks.
That's just so not fair.
I agree. It's not fair.
This all leads me to a term that you've coined, which is pulchronomics, the economics of beauty. Define that for us.
Just the notion that beauty is scarce, like air in a scuba tank or like diamonds. And because it's scarce, it therefore becomes economics. Economics is about scarcity. So my purpose in the book, Beauty Pays, is simply to look at all those areas where this scarcity plays itself out. And jobs and pay are just one of them.
You talk about how better-looking people get better deals on mortgages. Better-looking professors right in your neck of the woods get better ratings from their students. How does that make you feel every time you start a new school year? Of course, I haven't seen you. Perhaps it's not a problem at all.
No, it is. You don't want to do that. You don't want to see me. Actually, I put myself on a 5-to-1 scale right in the middle. And I tell friends, I get very good ratings from my students anyway. But if I were a 5, really good looking, I'd get the best ratings in the whole university. So, yeah, I'm not happy about it either. I'm not happy in terms of borrowing, not for mortgages so much, for unsecured loans, that the better looking people get better deals. It's unfair. I think I would call it discrimination rather than somehow that looks are productive, but that's the way it is.
In this country, we really make a point, particularly in the legal system, to offer all kinds of protections in an effort to level the playing field on everything from gender to race to religion. What do you do with looks?
I see no reason logically why you shouldn't do the same protection for the truly, really bad looking, the bottom 1 or 2%, that we do for the disabled. It's relatively non-changeable. It's not something that's easily remedied. The losses are substantial. So on logical grounds, I just don't see much of an argument against it. The argument against it's political. We have in this country so few resources to offer these protections that I'd worry about expanding rights to another group because I'm afraid that would take away from the protections we now offer to certain groups that I care more about personally. But you may think protecting the bad-looking is the most important protection we can offer, and that's a fine political opinion.
So for those of us who are not Heidi Klum or Brad Pitt, what are we supposed to do about this, if anything? What do we do with this information?
I think what we do is suck it up in the sense that you can't. No, seriously. I mean, you can't do anything much about it.
Yeah.
And so try not to worry about it and try to take advantage of all the things that you do have. One's intelligence, one's good humor, personality, all those things are at least as important in affecting how we do in the job market and other markets too. The other point is just to think about that there's so many things that affect how well we do, and this is only one of them, and that's important for people who might be looks challenged to understand and to know.
Daniel Hammermisch is an economics professor at the University of Texas at Austin and the author of Beauty Pays. Sir, it's been, I suppose, a beautiful experience talking with you. Thank you so much.
It has for me. Thank you too.
You can find more about beauties, beasts, and bucks on our Big Book blog. It's at marketplace.org/thebigbook. When you think of the victims of investment fraud, who do you picture as the typical mark? Little old lady? A person with no financial know-how? Well, think again and listen up, because this is a problem that is growing in size and scope with each passing day of the economic downturn. The AARP did a study that looked at the victims of investment fraud, and we are joined by the man who heads up the organization in Washington State and who also happens to be a former fraud investigator and assistant attorney general there. Doug Shadell, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
So what was your study about? What were you looking to find?
The AARP Foundation study was about comparing the general public from people we've identified as victims of fraud to see, is there a difference in how they behave, how they look at the world, and who they are demographically? And we found, of course, that there were differences.
Well, let's talk about those. You know, I think probably the image that springs to mind is someone who is perhaps on the latter side of life, particularly looking for help with managing their money. Is that accurate?
Well, a lot of the victims in our study were, in fact, older, and we didn't ask for just older victims because we're AARP. But what a lot of times people have in their mind that a victim of fraud is someone who's lost their mind. You know, they may have cognitive impairment. They're elderly widows living alone. And while that is clearly a segment of this victim population, there's also a huge population of investment fraud victims who are just the opposite. They tend to be wealthier. They tend to have more education than the general public. And most interestingly, they tend to be more financially literate than the general public.
Well, that's really interesting, particularly in light of, you know, what we've heard about Bernie Madoff's victims. You know, there were a lot of really smart and wealthy people who fell for that.
Absolutely right. And one of the in the case of Bernie Madoff, and we found this in some of our studies, a lot of times people don't simply have time or they don't do due diligence. They rely on the opinion of a friend, you know. And in that case also, ask people, what was I investing in? And a lot of them couldn't tell you. You know, there's actually some very simple ways to avoid this. It's just that a lot of times people don't do them.
Did you get any sense of why we don't? Is it because we're afraid that we're not going to know the difference anyway, that we just don't have time to do our homework?
I think it's overdetermined. That is, there are multiple reasons. You know, I interviewed a guy who was a retired chemistry professor. He lost $900,000 to a movie investment scam,
oh,
or a series of them. And when you ask him, well, why didn't you ask all these questions and do this due diligence? He goes, you know, I'm from a university community. Everyone I deal with for 40 years is trustworthy.
Hmm.
And it never occurred to me that somebody would look me in the eye and lie directly. Now, you could say, oh, on one level, that's a level of naivete. But when you think about it, we do tend to trust the people who we operate with day in and day out. And if those people are generally trustworthy, you get into this sort of false sense of security. The other big thing that we have found in our research in interviewing con men is that they all say they're trying to do the same thing to the victim, and that is get them under the ether.
Hmm.
What do we mean by ether? Ether is a heightened emotional state where you're excited to make a lot of money, or there's some other reason why they can get you off balance and making a decision based on emotion. And once they've – and one con man said, I get them into the heights of ether. If they drop to the valley of logic, then I've lost them.
Jeez. Well, you know, you actually have some audio of a con man trying to persuade someone, although he didn't know that person was an undercover agent. Let's give a listen to that.
I said I would not call unless it was a rare and definitely undervalued situation. Are you familiar with the $2.50 gold Indian series?
Now, John, back in 1860 from the Philadelphia Mint, there were 22,675 of these coins minted. Of those 22,000, only four have survived. Only four!
Take and write down what I'm going to tell you and do this exactly as I tell you and don't switch up on me again, okay?
If you don't want to make up your mind right now, that's where I come in. I will make up your mind for you.
All right, so this was obviously a few examples of con men who have been caught in the act. But, I mean, I don't know. You know, I listen to those and I think, well, if I ever heard one of those people on my phone, of course I would hang up. So yep. What is it that gets people to trust them?
Yeah, I mean, it's, again, it can be a complex series of things. But those tapes you listened to were one or several of 300 or more tapes that we transcribed and analyzed to see, are there common tactics that are common to all the different kinds of scams? And the ones you heard there are common, where it says, you know, they're minted 22,000 coins and there are only four left. Mm. What is that? That's the tactic of scarcity. So there's something in our gut that goes back to the alligator brain in us that says, if something, you know, if you're running out of food, must get food. If you're running out of coins, must get coin. And it causes your gut to panic and you start thinking irrationally. Before this call, I never even wanted a coin, and now somehow I need it, right?
Right,
and so I think a lot of that is what's going on, and the people on these phones are experts at what they do.
Right, I guess that's why they call them confidence men, right?
There you go.
If it is one of those things where, you know, there's this dinosaur portion of our brain that's taking over, how do we fight against that? How do you keep yourself from falling victim to something like this?
Yeah, I mean, I think getting back to the study, one of the things we found in the studies is that victims differ from non-victims in a couple important ways. One way they differ is that they expose themselves to the marketplace more. Hmm. They're much more likely to go to a free lunch seminar or a free dinner seminar. They're more likely to read junk mail. They're more likely to send away for a free CD. So the combination of exposing yourself to sales situations more and possibly having a lower threshold where that emotion is triggered, low self-control, you might say, is the combination of the two. So one simple way to avoid this is to not expose yourself too much to the sales situations. But then if you do and you feel that heartbeat starting to palpitate, you know, you're starting to get excited, simply wait for it to go away so that the emotional part of your mind can subside. And you can just ask a couple simple due diligence questions. And most of the problems we see in this area would go away if people did that.
Doug Shadell is the state director for the AARP in Washington State, and we've been talking about that organization's study on victims of investment scams. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And finally to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is heading to Berlin, specifically the office of German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who not only saved money this week, she arguably saved an entire currency for now. Merkel pushed through an expansion of a bailout fund for Eurozone countries teetering on the edge of insolvency. We don't know that it will solve all the problems over there, or here for that matter, but at least it is something. All I ask is that you not turn our friend into bratwurst. That is Marketplace Money for this week. You can friend us and me too on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, a tough but important story.
Most women who are in a domestic violence situation have been controlled. And the biggest control that the abuser has is financial.
Marketplace Money is produced by John Buckley with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.